Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of presentation, they are as follows. Janice Davis versus Carl Griffith Jr. and others, and C.J. Herbert versus Carl Griffith Jr. and others, both from Jefferson County and consolidated for oral argument. Gary Grounds versus Toller Independent School District from Hood County, and Allstate Insurance Company versus Kathleen G. Watson from Tarrant County. The court has allotted different times for petitioners and respondents in each of these causes, and counsel should have been advised of those time allotments. If you wish to reserve a portion of your time as petitioners for rebuttal, please so advise the marshal. The light system, which has served us so well for 35 years, does not work. And there, would you, Mr. Marshall, would you show an example of the cards? We will be relying on card signals from the marshal, so please keep your eyes over there every once in a while, and I will try to warn you at the appropriate intervals as well. These arguments are being recorded. For the court's convenience, you may make application to listen to a tape of these arguments with the clerk of our court if you so desire. The court will take a brief recess in between each of the presentations, but we will, of course, conclude all three before lunch. We're now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Davis and Hebert versus Griffith.
May it please the court, Mr. Lawrence Watts will present argument for petitioner for 20 minutes, opening for 15 minutes, reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, this is a case where we claim that in two identical situations, the Ninth Court of Appeals improvidently granted summary judgment. And they did so because of the fact that protected fundamental rights were present, had not been disposed of by summary judgment. Specifically, we're talking about two deputies in the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department who we believe have a cause of action that arises not only under various cases recognizing that Article 1, Section 8 is alive and well, but that the court did not correctly find that fact issues were absent.
Is this suit brought under 42 U.S.C. 1983?
It's principally brought under Article 1, Section 8.
There's an allegation in respondent's brief, but it's only under the state constitution. Is that
at
right
the motion,
or wrong?
At the motion for summary judgment level, they treated it as if it were also brought under Title 42, or under the First Amendment.
What did you plead?
Well, the pleading was, we mentioned specifically, Mr. Chief Justice, Article 1, Section 8, but the pleading was broad enough that, and frankly, the law was undecided enough, we felt, in certain areas, that we had raised First Amendment issues, either because of the fact that they're congruent and similar issues to Article 1, Section 8, or because of the fact that 1983 type claims, and I'll use First Amendment claims under the umbrella of 1983 type for purposes of argument, were present. We filed suit under Article 1, Section 8. I think that they recognize that the First Amendment was also present, but principally is Article 1, Section 8.
What is the state analog to 42 U.S.C. 1983 that permits you to bring this suit?
I don't think that you have to have a legislative authorization to enforce the Constitution. To do so would place the creature supreme to the Creator.
Are you seeking damages or merely
seeking damages? We seek three types of relief: injunctive relief being part, damages being part. And let me point out while we're talking about that, we have to look to constitutional logic, I suspect, as it's in the federal forum, as it's been recognized there. And there are two cases that say something, I think, to where you seek damages. First of all, 1983 I don't think applies, because 1983 is in effect Clause 5 of the 14th Amendment, as you know, which came into existence because we had a post-Civil War Congress that didn't know quite how to adjust the rights of citizens in states that had once been autonomous and separate sovereigns and reintegrating them into the national fabric. But when we have a fundamental right, as we have here, which has basis in at least three amendments and safeguarded by a fourth, we need to have a remedy that means something. In Bivens versus six unknown narcotics agents, the Supreme Court of the United States said, damages may be obtained for injuries consequent upon a violation of the Fourth Amendment by federal officials should hardly seem a surprising proposition. Historically, damages have been regarded as the ordinary remedy for an invasion of personal interest and liberty. In another Supreme Court case, in the Owens case, at 445 U.S. 622, the court said how uniquely amiss it would be, therefore, if the government itself, the social organ to which all in our society look for the promotion of liberty, justice, fair and equal treatment, and the setting of worthy norms and goals for social conduct, were permitted to disavow liability for the injury it's begotten. A damages remedy against the offending party is a vital component of any scheme for vindicating cherished constitutional guarantees, and the importance of assuring the efficacy is only accentuated when the wrongdoer is the institution that's been established to protect the very rights it's transgressed. I think that it's a false issue to say that the citizens of Texas must have legislative approval or endorsement to vindicate fundamental constitutional rights in state courts. It certainly seems to turn the world upside down in terms of constitutional primacy. In this particular case, we have a recognition, I think, clear recognition by Texas courts, although in general terms, plus Supreme Court of the United States recognition that political considerations can't play a part in hiring or disciplinary proceedings that result even in loss of jobs.
Well, let me focus in on this case then, instead of the broader philosophy that you've been discussing. That case, of course, talked about the rights of low-level employees with reference to expression. And there you had a road equipment operator and a prison guard and a rehabilitation counselor. Is there still a role for political considerations and patronage considerations for the first assistant to a sheriff? Or the legislative aid to a legislator, or is a Republican sheriff stuck with a Democratic first assistant and a Democratic legislator stuck with a Republican legislative aide?
Yes, they're stuck with them. The cases, and Rutan, of course, is one case that comes to mind. But when you talk about Elrod versus Burns, and when you talk about Branty, you're talking specifically about cases which recognize that in certain instances a person can be so high up, a policymaker, if you will, for an entity, a governmental actor, that person need be consistent in philosophy with the governmental actor, and patronage is a legitimate consideration. In this instance, we don't have that. No one's ever contended that Davis or Hebert, and it should be Hebert in Louisiana, Hebert in Texas is how my client calls it, but no one's ever contended that Davis and Hebert are policymakers, are of such high level of positions, or were of such high level positions, that they fall within the exception in Elrod versus Burns. No one's contended that. But certainly I think that we've seen also in Congress, we've seen cases, the Passman case comes to mind, where you had a female assistant to a congressman who was protected constitutionally from certain violative acts that infringed upon fundamental precepts. This case, and we have the fundamental right. I mean, the Constitution has to mean something. We have all of the lip service that says that the Texas Constitution is broad. It's greater in breadth than the federal Constitution. But we have not even consistently recognized an iota of that strength and virility in trial courts. As one member of the courts noted, if trial courts don't know that the state constitution is viable and firm, they should know that. And that's basically what we're dealing with. In this particular instance, this court is beginning to articulate clearly principles that have been somewhat garbled through all sort of miscreant views, I think, at trial court level of immunity. I think it's extremely odd that government would claim that it's immune from being responsible to the Constitution which created government. It certainly seems to smack that 29 as a section has no viability at all. In this particular case, though, I think we've got the right. I'm eating my time up. Number two, I think the summary judgment was improvidently granted. The difference between Davis and Hebert is this. In Davis, there was no controverting proof by the plaintiff, the appellant, the petitioner. It didn't have to be, because Davis sees Griffith presenting an affidavit and excerpts from his own deposition as taken in the Hebert case, which create fact issues. And if we look at Casso versus Brand, where the court recognizes that instances occur where the, specifically Casso at 558, the credibility of the affiant's opponent is likely to be the dispositive factor for the resolution of the case, then summary judgment is inappropriate. Even the amicus recognized that in their brief when they cite Anthony versus Sundland, a First Circuit case, and they say specifically in their quote, notwithstanding a person's disclaimers, a contrary state of mind may be inferred from what he does and from a factual mosaic tending to show that he really meant to accomplish that which he professes not to have intended. In this particular case, Griffith was all over himself. He came from two different positions in the Davis case. His affidavit and his deposition show that he was not consistent, and that if credibility ever could be an issue, he certainly placed it into issue. Specifically, he said, well, I only reduced by 10 because I had to have only 10. Then he comes back and says, well, I really increased by 32 or 37. There are certainly many reasons why summary judgment should not have been granted, accepting the position that we have a protected fundamental interest at stake.
Counsel, what's the role of sovereign immunity and qualified immunity of a government's agents play in all this? Is there any role?
Well, first of all, there are affirmative defenses which must be pled, and they weren't in this case. Number two, I'm not sure that sovereign immunity can exist in the state courts when you're dealing with issues of constitutional nature. Let me explain that just for a moment, please. The 11th Amendment is a peculiar anomaly. Sovereign immunity is an anomaly. Even in England, whence we came, there, Blackstone recognizes that the sovereign was not immune. But we sort of built it up and strapped on things, I think, that weren't there even then. Now we have a situation in the 11th Amendment. All right, if you're going to sue the state and federal court, then what you have to do is to have state permission. And what constitutes that permission? That's up in the air, and that's all over the place. We have a test now that's been set out in federal court, federal jurisprudence for the 11th Amendment issues, that sets basically, I think, about 6 points that we'll look for. But we don't have that type of a question here. You can still file a 1983 action under the federal constitution in state court. And 11th Amendment doesn't apply. Sovereign immunity doesn't apply. Article 2 of the federal constitution says that's the supreme law of the land. If that's the supreme law of the land, there is no sovereign other than the constitution, which creates government, which is not sovereign to the Constitution. Under qualified immunity is a totally different issue, I think. Qualified immunity is a creature that we've seen recently go through some particularly unusual birthings and rebirthings. It's subjective. It's objective. Well, now we realize that it's objective with a touch of subjectivity. But what it means is we can't harass government officials to the point where they can't do their job. All right, that's fine. But when you have that issue, which has not been raised here, when you have that issue, you're dealing with a very bright line test. Was there clearly, in federal jurisprudence, was there clearly established constitutional precepts which were violated if plaintiff is right in this case? In Texas, I'm not sure we have qualified. There are as many different forms of immunity as trial judges could think of and appellate courts would allow to stand historically. It's not a consistent pattern. I don't know that I said anything that helped you, but I hope so at this point. The point is that in Hebert, we've got a clear violation, I think, of 166 by the court, because there were fact issues remaining about not only the fundamental right giving us a cause of action and Griffith's motivation, where he only needed 10, cut 10, and hired 32 to 37, but we also have Hebert saying, in his own affidavit, the man told me that I had to thank former Sheriff Culbertson for the situation I'm currently in. We had not only Griffith all over the field, but we had clearly fact issues that were summarily disposed of. I'm reminded of an opinion called Pred versus Board out of the Fifth Circuit, written by a man that we'll probably all miss, former Chief Judge John Brown. But he started off...
Time has expired, Jim. I should have given you a five-minute warning.
I'm sorry.
Leaning too far back.
But he just simply said this is a monument to waste of lawyers' time, clients' money, and judges' time. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Blood, and Ms. Howard, will respond to you.
May it please the court. I think if there's one thing that is reasonably clear, it is that the law in this area is not at all reasonably clear. And that makes it a very difficult case to defend from the standpoint of defending a newly elected sheriff. And makes it a very difficult case, I think, at least on the prospects of what cause of action are we attempting to embrace and throw our arms around, makes it a very difficult moving target to hit and a very difficult task for this court, from which I find simply no guidance in the legal precedent that's available. And let me focus in on what I mean. The Elrod versus Burns line of cases, and if you'll read them carefully, you'll find that the Supreme Court and all the cases following that, while it makes some general pronouncements concerning the practice of partisanship, one of the things that it notes is partisanship is a great big political monster. And it is. It covers a wide range of activities, some of which may be subject to criticism, some of which may be not subject to criticism. And every time the Supreme Court of the United States has stopped with party affiliation, and the underlying facts are not in dispute that party affiliation, this typically arises out of Illinois. I don't know why. Apparently it's a very customary practice there that to get a job you've got to be signed up with the right folks. And if you're not signed up with the right folks, you don't get a job. But even in the latest pronouncement, which is Rutan versus Republican Party of Illinois, 16 years after Elrod versus, or 14 years after Elrod versus Burns, they finally said, okay, application for employment, same problem as threatened discharge. You don't have to be a member of a sponsoring political party. That's not an appropriate qualification. I don't care
if the job has nothing to do with politics.
Assuming that the job, that there's no legitimate relationship between party membership and the job to be performed.
Which there might be.
There certainly could be in certain cases, although I think that's a one of those case-by-case factual determinations. And being a briefing clerk for a judge or a first assistant district attorney may or may not be a relevant job description depending on your party affiliation. I think that opens the door to a potentially endless litigation, but nevertheless, that's where I believe the law is. Then we come down to the Fifth Circuit, and we have two cases, one of which I've cited in my brief, one of which I ran across later, and I'll give you the cite to it. But one's Tanner versus McCall, and the other one is Soderstrom versus the town of Grand Isle. That's 925 Federal 2nd 135, 1991 decision of the Fifth Circuit. Both of those cases dodge the issue as to whether or not a cause of action exists when the political association that is reputed to be the basis for termination or not being rehired, as in the case of Tanner v. McCall, turns on political loyalty to a man rather than political loyalty to a party.
If this is so up in the air, how come we should affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals?
Well, I'll get to that. I think that's a separate issue. First of all, I think the issue is that there is no cause of action recognized in the law where the political association is one supported to an individual, one I'd suggest that may be more related to long period of, or tenure of employment rather than to any political leanings or policies or associations, which runs you straight to the local government code where deputy sheriffs are appointed for terms. Those terms terminate with the sheriff. There's no entitlement to reappointment. You run across that whole gamut of things.
You're suggesting that the terminations in this case were on account of personal affiliation. Why didn't the sheriff just say that?
Well, I don't think the sheriff's in a position to necessarily know that.
Let me
get to, well, I don't think the sheriff necessarily knew these people personally in order to be able to say that.
He knows whether he discharged them or not and what for.
Let me get to the facts of this case then. I think some broad statements have been made concerning where the summary judgment evidence is that I don't think are correct. First of all, this isn't simply a case where the summary judgment says, I didn't do it for that reason, give me summary judgment, I'm out of here. That's not what this is about. What this is about is that the sheriff, the incoming sheriff, knew that at least 50 to 60 members of the staff were supporters of Sheriff Culbertson. Now, that's readily documented because they signed a letter that was published in the newspaper during a political campaign. So he knew at least that many people on a 200-man staff were supporters of former Sheriff Culbertson.
But wouldn't it be reasonable for him to assume that every one of them were?
Well, unless they had inside information otherwise.
They worked for the man.
I think it's certainly reasonable to assume that they were loyal from an employment standpoint. I don't necessarily think that makes them political supporters. And I don't think it would be an appropriate inquiry to find out how everybody voted, to find out whether they were supporters or not. But suffice it to say that at least 50 to 60 of them felt strongly enough about it that they signed a letter that was published in the paper. Now, the 10 to 37 issue is kind of misleading. 37 was the number of new hires as of the time the sheriff's deposition had been taken. As you know from county government, sheriffs can't just go out and hire people because they want to. Budget positions and budget slots have got to be approved by commissioner's court. We've been through a budget year since then. Positions were increased because we have increased numbers of prisoners in the jail. Beside the point, the facts were 10 people were added to the administration. 10 slots had to be vacated because sheriffs take office at the 1st of January. Budget positions are approved at the 1st of October. The timing doesn't match. A new sheriff can't go in and be sure, I guess you can never go in and be sure, that you'll have additional budgetary slots, but the timing's not there. So there are 10 people replaced. Two of those people are complaining and filing suits. That leaves 40 to 50 others, known public vocal supporters of the former sheriff, continuing on in the new administration. Now, if none of that's true,
then it seems to me it was incumbent upon the plaintiffs to bring forward an affidavit, some sort of summary judgment proof, that says the sheriff's lying about that. In fact, he replaced every single known Culberson supporter he could find. He replaced them all. Well, that didn't happen. So where is there any evidence that those who were replaced because of their political support for the man in Culberson?
Counsel,
it's simply not there.
You agree with your opposing counsel that their pleadings are broad enough to encompass state and federal claims?
I do. It's probably one of the few things we agree about, but I do agree with that. I think their pleadings are very broad, and I think necessarily couched that way because we don't know where the parameters are of this cause of action that they're attempting to describe. Wherever they are, I think they're not within the summary judgment proof in this particular case.
Was there summary judgment proof offered by your opponent on Davis?
No, there was not.
No summary judgment proof at all?
No, sir.
Was there any response?
There was a response. There was an argument and a brief filed. But there was no summary judgment proof offered in response. In the Hebert case, another factor brought forward by the summary judgment proof, as a matter of fact, established by our summary judgment and uncontroverted, the division in which Mr. Hebert worked was abolished as a part of the reorganization of the new administration. Formerly, the Sheriff's Department, in addition to serving warrants and doing criminal matters, served civil citations, papers, and civil cases. After the new sheriff took office, they didn't do that anymore. That division was abolished. The constables now do all that work. If that were not true, or if at least there were a fact issue as to that, it was incumbent under the Casso decision for the plaintiff to bring forward some evidence that that in fact is not true.
Is it true that the summary judgment record includes testimony by former Sheriff Culberson that in his opinion the Sheriff Griffith's decisions were politically motivated?
That is correct.
And is it also true that the record contains a statement of Sheriff Griffith, statement by Hebert, who says that Sheriff Griffith told him that he was not reappointed because of Culberson?
That is correct.
Why don't those statements raise fact issues, including summary judgment?
Two reasons. First, as to Sheriff Culberson. Sheriff Culberson testified, and it was crystal clear, and I set that out, and it is in the record, that it was his personal opinion that C.J. Hebert was terminated for political reasons. When I asked him on his deposition if he had any factual basis for that opinion at all, he said he did not. It was just a personal opinion that he held. I would suggest that that's incompetent evidence to be presented in support of any fact issue, that the personal beliefs and opinions unsupported by any factual basis simply are not sufficient to be admissible or to factually support the conclusion. The other item is, I would suggest to you that the because of Culbertson language gives you no clue as to what it is C.J. Hebert may have done or been involved in that resulted in his termination. It's ambiguous. It's subject to multiple interpretations, one of which I really don't believe is capable of the construction that petitioners would like to put on it. And that is because C.J. Hebert supported Sheriff Culbertson, he's out of a job. In the broadest sense, that simply is not true. The reasonable construction is that because Culbertson is no longer in the position, because there were some changes that need to be made, because we're constrained by a limited number of slots, somebody had to go to bring new people in. Simply must be that way. Some people must lose their jobs if there are to be any changes made below the office of sheriff only.
So your argument is that Davis and Hebert were not reappointed because there was no other way to structure the department?
No, there are other ways to structure the department. Then we just change the people who lose their jobs, which brings us to the very interesting proposition, if we follow down this road, that the people who were the least political active, the most unknown, who did nothing, maybe just went to the polls and voted, become the people who are the most vulnerable in losing their jobs when you have a change in administration. because they can't stand up and say, I think he got rid of me because I voted for the losing incumbent, because they did nothing. They weren't public, whereas the people who are the most public, the most vocal, the most likely to cause problems, if you follow where this is going, are the people with the greatest guarantee to future or continued employment.
In its last writing on this subject, the U.S. Supreme Court noted that there was an exception for policymaking and confidential employees, but indicated that they didn't have to consider the scope of that exception in that particular case in Illinois, because the state conceded that all of the employees, the road grader and the prison guard and the like, fell outside of it. Do you concede that in this case?
I concede in this case that the two people who lost their jobs were not policymaking employees. I do not concede that that ends the issue for discussion in this case. Here's the problem. That does not take into account, and apparently was not present in that case, the desire of a new elected official to reorganize the office. It may very well be that people who are in policy-making decisions, policy-making positions, are going to be replaced, but those people retained is the better way to run the organization. And the bottom line is that some other person may end up losing their job. And I'm not sure, where you don't have a direct replacement, that that's an issue at all in the Hebert case.
Is the only evidence that this was a politically motivated firing in this record that of the opinion testimony of former Sheriff Culbertson?
Unless you want to stretch the because of Culbertson language as somehow implying that that's also an indication of a motivation of political reason for a discharge.
Well, isn't it?
I don't believe it is at all.
Why not?
Well, because I believe it's capable of the construction, and frankly, it's a construction that perhaps I was remiss in not bringing forward in my summary judgment proofs. But the truth of the matter is there was no opportunity for attrition to work. Sheriff Griffith had asked to come on board to the sheriff's office early. He did not. He remained an investigator in our office to allow by attrition to create the openings he needed to bring the 10 key people onto the payroll he wanted. It's not in the summary judgment evidence, but that's certainly as reasonable a construction of that because of Culbertson language as is to leap to the conclusion that the only thing that can mean is that because Hebert supported Culbertson, Hebert is losing his job. I think that's a real stretch of that.
It's your position that if you can, you have 5 minutes remaining. If you can go outside the record and come up with an equally plausible explanation that's innocent, then that should support a summary judgment as a matter
of
law.
No, it is not. No, that's not my position. My position is that the construction that they want to place on that simply is one of perhaps many constructions, if we stretch our imagination, that may go with it. But not one that I think necessarily flows from the language that's quoted. I just don't think that construction's there. If that, in fact, is what, if the sheriff had said, look, I'm letting you go because you politically supported Culbertson, then that would be fine. But I'm not sure what we do.
It would be a foolish sheriff that said that, wouldn't it?
It certainly wouldn't be very bright. I would think that would potentially cause you some problems, assuming that we can throw a noose around this cause of action and stop it somewhere.
Assuming that people will be more subtle than that, what other kinds of evidence is part of it?
I think exactly the kinds of things that I've talked about, Your Honor. If, in fact, the known public supporters of Culbertson, some 50 or 60 of them, were all terminated, then I think you could conclude from that 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 was punishment for having done that. Where you have a very small number of people who've been terminated, many public supporters of the predecessor remain in office, I think you have to look for some other reason, because the fact of political support simply isn't there. One caveat, let's assume that the only people who supported Culbertson were the big money contributors. Well, then you might have a problem, but where's that evidence in the record? It's not there because it isn't true in this case, but if it were, then I think you might have a fact issue you can go resolve. But the facts that are capable of easy refutation, that is, how many jobs were changed out, who were the people who left, who were the people who stayed, and their political support. I think if you start looking at those kinds of things, then you find that facts which are capable of being easily refuted, which only point to one conclusion, and that is that there was a change of administration going on, not political punishment, then you're left with a situation where even if we assume a cause of action exists, this particular case was ripe for summary judgment.
Is there any reason why Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution does not protect the freedom of expression of at least public employees?
Well, I think not. And I think freedom of expression of public employees is protected. I think it's protected when they speak about public issues under the First Amendment. I think their freedom to associate with political parties and the known differences in beliefs in political parties are protected. I think that's very clear.
What about their freedom of expression to say that someone who's running against their boss is sorry?
I think as long as you are talking about subjects that are fair public comment, I think that's a protection.
So you don't have a problem with this court saying that under Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution, if a public employee is dismissed because of comments that they made during a political campaign, that's a violation of the Texas Constitution?
If we can isolate those comments, and if they were fair comments on matters of public concern, no, I don't have a problem.
And you don't have a problem in permitting an action for damages based on that violation of the Constitution?
Assuming that there's proof that that, in fact, took place. No, I don't have a problem with that.
Without any separate legislative action?
I don't think a separate legislative action under the Constitution is necessary under the precedence of this court. I don't. And that's why immunity issues, frankly, weren't raised.
That's another matter that you and opposing counsel really agree on. It's a question of whether in this particular case the record really supports an action to enforce constitutional rights guaranteed by the freedom of expression of our Texas Bill of Rights.
Well, and I think we do agree on the broad principle. In this case, I don't believe that's there.
Counsel, what precedents do you refer to when you talk about awarding the damages for constitutional torts under the Texas Constitution in the absence of a Texas analog in 1983?
You may have me in a significant problem because I have not briefed that issue.
Well, I'd invite you, and I know the court would as a whole invite you to file a supplemental letter brief if you have some that you'd like to bring to our attention.
I would like to do that in light of a rather lengthy brief that counsel filed today that I saw for the first time.
The time has expired. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Bill.
May it please the Court, Justice Cornyn, there is my response to that would be, and I'll also provide you the letter brief, that there is no hierarchy of amendments. Damages are not necessarily limited to one amendment as opposed to another. The Constitution sets all amendments as fundamental rights. You can get damages for Article 1, Section 17, as we know. We also know that in the Jones case, Chief Judge Evans, and by the way, right of privacy, that's been extrapolated into a private tort, but you can still come back and recover money for violation of that particular right. And then to keep in mind Owens and Bivens. And justice, and whether we have the cause of action, Chief Judge Evans in a case which did not have a writ history, said Jones v. Memorial Hospital System that Article 1, Section 8 of the Texas Constitution constitutes an independent legal basis for a cause of action claiming an infringement of the right of free speech guaranteed by that section of the state constitution. A right without a remedy would be a rare right and peculiar indeed, and probably we shouldn't even spend this much time talking about it.
Counsel, every time there's a change of administration, whether it be the county constitutional county judge or the sheriff or the district judge or whomever is elected in Texas, are we always going to have a potential jury question?
I don't know. Marbury,
that the reason that the former employees were let go or replaced was because of their political speech?
You may or you may not. It depends upon the crassness, I suspect, of the way that the individual liberties are handled by the successor to office.
Well, even if the office holder does not is incautious enough or unsubtle enough if they are so subtle as to not say anything, but in the event some person who qualifies to render expert opinion says in their opinion, that's the reason they were fired. Isn't that enough to get to the jury under your argument?
No. No, I think that, but in this particular case, Culbertson wasn't factless about Davis. If that's where you're going, and I don't know that's where you
I'm
are
I'm just
going.
Asking whether that issue could be supported by opinion testimony only in the absence of any overt statements made by the office holder.
I don't think Drugstore Dan's opinion on who got cut for what reason is sufficient to get you to a jury. I think that you have to have a little bit more than that, and I think that there have been certainly protections that have been provided within when I started trying civil rights cases 25 years ago, we couldn't go to juries because we didn't know that we could go to juries. We thought we had mixed questions of fact and law. We always had to go to the judge. And then came Doyle versus Mount Healthy and said First Amendment is available, full of fact issues, rife with fact issues that need to be decided by a fact finder, and you can go to a jury. It sets out the test. We go to the jury with those First Amendment issues. And I don't see the system encumbered or failing because people's fundamental rights being urged to somehow dismantle the entire federal system. I don't think you'd have the problem. I think that floodgate fear, which we might all have, is simply not a realistic fear in this case. I think that even if it were, the fundamental rights are so important, they're so supreme, especially in a society where we're now for the first time beginning to deal and debate very important issues even on television, with communication being what it is. I think that we have to make some allowances for the fact that this type of cases will come up. Let me cover a couple of other things.
Let me ask you just one other thing. Do we have any summary judgment evidence here concerning the nature of the expression during the course of the campaign of
Dan Davis?
Davis and Abel?
Yes, sir. They supplied it for us, and that's part of being all over the board where Griffith was. Culbertson testifies. They pick out for you one statement where Culbertson says, well, I don't have any factual basis for it, but then they forget to go on and say, well, yes, but he was told that Jan Davis was handing out a card. Culbertson's at the polling place, and Culbertson's wife says, she's got to go. Now, Culbertson denies in his deposition, which you have before you, presented by them, that his wife played any such role. But nevertheless, you do have that fact basis before you. Second of all, fact basis, you have a fact issue as to Griffith's own mental processes. He never disposed of that as an interested party, and he never got out of Castle versus Brand. Number two, the counsel says it's a matter of construction on these different facts. Construction's a fact issue. Number three, he says, well, I believe that if you have the First Amendment carried over into Texas jurisprudence, Article 1, Section 8 protects people where they're speaking on a matter of general public concern. You know, that's one of the differences between Article 1, Section 8 and the First Amendment. First Amendment seems to say that you can only have a protected right under the relativist concept where you're speaking on a matter of general public concern. Article 1, Section 8 says any issue.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Boy, it is.
Are there any questions? Talk fast.
I promise. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Notice, please rise.